Today on Vox Talks, where next for Europe's trade strategy? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. In 2016, the EU published Trade for All, and that was the name of its trade strategy. It promised that trade policy would be more effective at delivering new economic opportunities, more transparent, and it would address not just interests, but also values. Well, we're not in 2016 anymore. And so how has thinking on globalisation and trade changed, and how should the EU's trade policy adapt? That's the theme of a new ebook. It's published this week, downloadable from VoxEU, and it's called Europe's Trade Strategy for the Age of Geo-Economic Globalization. Christian Bluth is the author. He is Senior Expert for Globalization, International Economics and Trade Policy at Bertelsmann Stiftung, and he is here today. Christian, welcome to Vox Talks.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
In this book, Christian, your central argument, this is what you wrote, trade is being used more and more as a tool for power projection rather than for the generation of prosperity. Hasn't trade always been about power?
Yes, it has been, but maybe in a different way than we see it today. I think what we have seen over most of the post-war period is that countries did use their power to achieve more preferential market access or other advantageous ways for their companies to do business in other markets. But prosperity was the ultimate goal. What we are seeing lately is a reversal. Countries use their power to make other countries specifically dependent on them, and then they use this dependency to achieve political goals. In the international relations literature, this is called weaponized interdependence. And we see it more and more. I mean, one classic example is China's Belt and Road Initiative, but you could also highlight the US withholding certain technology from, for example, Huawei, in order to achieve specific political goals. And this is, of course, not linked to achieving prosperity, but really quite hard-nosed geostrategic agenda that is behind it. And we see this emerging more and more. It's not the end of globalization, because the strategy rests on continued economic relations with other countries, but it's a different kind of globalization that is aiming less at prosperity and more at geoeconomic objectives.
But is it inevitable that they have to forego some prosperity? Is there always that trade-off?
At least sometimes there is. I mean, think about a pretty blunt geoeconomic instrument such as sanctions. Of course, it hurts the country that you're sanctioning, but it also hurts the country that is sanctioning the other country because, well, you are not exporting certain things and you don't have the revenue that is associated with it.
You also write in the book that size matters in international trade. So how much does the EU matter on this dimension? Does it matter as much as it used to?
The fact that size matters is actually nothing new in trade economics. We know that market size has a huge effect, market attractiveness has a huge effect. And then, of course, it matters that the demographic weights in the world are changing profoundly. And especially Europe has shrinking and aging demography. And that means that the share of the EU in the world population in 2050 is going to be half of what it is now.
Wow.
And it's not exactly large at the time that we speak.
This book is all about what's changing and the trends that we're seeing. Now, you split them into political and non-political. Top of the non-political mega trends that you identify, climate change. So how is this affecting globalization?
In many ways, I think probably the most dramatic way is just the effect it has on agricultural production all over the world. We see, and here it ties in with the demographic question that you asked me earlier, that especially in those areas where population is going to grow rapidly, agricultural yields will diminish or at least become much more uncertain. Obviously, some answer to this problem has to do with trade, especially in agricultural goods. But the impact of climate change is much larger than that. I mean, severe weather events can not only disrupt agricultural production, it could also disrupt the production of industrial goods. So this is one of the many elements that I discuss in my book that just introduce an element of risk in global production chains. Dealing with that risk from climate change and other sources is one of the big challenges to just make production chains more resilient. There's one further element that's actually really important, because in order to combat climate change, more and more countries are becoming carbon neutral. And one important tool to do this is that emissions are increasingly priced. So that can have an effect on competitive advantages, because carbon prices might be different in one country than another, and that might give the country where it's cheaper a competitive advantage. So we'll see the introduction of carbon border adjustment mechanisms. The European Union is currently working on one. That can also have a disruptive effect on trade, especially if those are perceived or designed as protectionist measures.
I want to pick up what you were saying about agriculture. Can we redesign the EU's trade policy to make that agricultural trade reflect need more? It's often been criticised for protecting certain interests rather than being optimal for trade.
Yes, well, that's a huge challenge because it's massively complicated. I mean, the EU is in a relatively good position. Forecasts are that its agricultural production is not going to be too negatively affected by climate change. It might actually expand a little bit. But of course, you don't want heavily subsidized European goods to drive poor farmers in developing countries out of the market. So I think what you need is a flexible mechanism that if there really is a shortage of food and risk of malnutrition in the population in certain areas, you have a mechanism that kicks in that allows imports, and that situation is treated differently from the normal situation. So a contingent mechanism that could be linked actually to the AMIS system, so that's a system that monitors prices for commodities, that I think would be a very smart strategy that would be very helpful to all parties involved.
Now, you mentioned as well that the EU's population is growing much more slowly than the world's population as a whole. The EU's getting older as well. Does this have any effect on trade dynamics other than the fact it makes the EU less significant in the world's economy?
Yes, but it's not quite clear in which way. So there is some research, but not very much, that suggests that older populations are less innovative. So that could be an effect to worry about, because the EU is already falling behind the US and China in terms of its innovative capacity. But maybe that's not written in stone. Maybe an aging population can actually be a fairly innovative one. An aging population also affects what people consume and what they produce. And again, that is an area on which there's not much research yet. For example, one thing that strikes me is how Japan and its trade policy has changed as a result of Japan's demographics. Japan has become much more open when it comes to agricultural trade than they used to before. And that has something to do with the average age of Japanese farmers now being in their 60s. Now, something similar could happen in Europe. Also, consumption patterns could change. I mean, we all know that old people consume different goods than young people do. So we don't really know very much about the effect of these changes, but it's very important to be aware that these effects might be there.
I was looking up all the things that have changed since 2016, and of course some of those are very much on our mind. But one thing I had forgotten about is in 2016 we did not have GDPR yet, the General Data Protection Regulation. That's been implemented since the last trade strategy. The EU has a good record on protecting privacy, but is it as strong in encouraging digital trade and innovating in that direction?
I think you're pointing your finger in the right direction. I mean, the EU is definitely right to protect its consumers, and I won't argue with that. But you can make an argument that the EU is maybe not doing enough to strengthen its digital industry, and that might even damage the competitiveness of non-digital industries, which of course rely on digital inputs. What I would argue is a really important strategy here is basically twofold. There's an inward-looking dimension. I think what is holding the EU back to quite some degree is that, especially for digital things, the single market is still quite fragmented, and that makes it very difficult for digital startups to scale up quickly and make full use of the single market. For example, a startup in the US has immediate access to all citizens of the US without any further legal costs or boundaries in between. The same is not true for inside the EU. But there's also an outward-looking dimension. I mean, it's quite important that we do have reliable rules for digital flows from country to country. And the EU has begun to incorporate this in their bilateral free trade agenda. There are also talks at the WTO. And it's quite important that those are brought forward and that we develop an international understanding what kind of restrictions are desirable because they actually support consumer protection. And what is harmful? The more we agree on a common denominator, the less this is going to lead to a race to the bottom in terms of consumer protection or create unfair competitive advantages.
So let's have a look at the political changes that have gone on. And of course, the last few years in trade have been dominated by the trade war between the US and China. And sometimes the EU has been almost a bystander in this, caught in the middle, perhaps. How should the EU be reacting to trade policies from China that it doesn't like?
Many countries in the world, amongst them the US and the EU, have issues with China that depend on certain trade policies. For example, there is the strong role of state-owned enterprises in China and the subsidies that they are receiving, which are perceived as distorting international competition. That's a major issue. Then there's lots that has to do with market access, with protection of intellectual property and the like. So the question is a bit, what is the right way of going about this? Trump trade policy was extremely confrontational with China. He launched complete trade war against China to obtain the phase one deal. The Europeans had a different strategy. They engaged with China in a series of talks that led to the comprehensive agreement on investment that was decided in principle at the end of 2020 and which will have to be ratified in the course of 2021. Both different styles have yielded results, but these results are probably not entirely addressing the concerns about China, both for the US and the EU. What I think really makes sense is that the EU and the US do what they haven't done under Trump and what they might do under Biden, which is sit down with China together and make their case in negotiations, make it constructively, show a clear path where they want China to go, do this ideally also in a multilateral way, roping in at some stage the WTO and other trade partners. And then I believe there's a real chance that the Chinese will see that addressing these trade policy concerns will also benefit them. They can do it in a face-saving way. And it doesn't have to be as confrontational as it was under Trump.
You mentioned the WTO there, and the Trump administration did not put much faith in multilateral institutions. And we've covered this on Vox Talks before. The WTO suffered and has entered a period of crisis as a result. How much effort should the EU be putting into strengthening the WTO again?
A lot of effort. I mean, I've called my book A Trade Strategy for the Age of Geoeconomic Globalization. But geoeconomics is actually something that doesn't suit European interests very well. The EU has to be able to defend itself against the use of geoeconomic instruments to obtain geostrategic objectives. But what, in an ideal world, the EU would like to do is basically continue liberal rules-based globalization as we have witnessed in many years before. And the WTO is the institution that actually makes sure there are rules, that enforces the rules, and that the rules are up to date. Now, all these functions, the negotiations of rules, the enforcement, and the up-to-date bit of the WTO are currently under strain. So I would say for the EU especially, but also for other trade powers, it's quite important to strengthen the rules-based international trade order rather than to weaken it. Ultimately, the EU depends a lot on the ability to do trade with the world. It does not really want to engage in a very confrontational style of geopolitics. And this liberal order is probably a good way to achieve this.
I left one topic until last, of course, COVID-19. Will this have a lasting impact on the EU's trade with the world?
That is a very difficult question. I mean, I wrote this book in the midst of the first wave of the pandemic, and it was very hard to disentangle what is just a momentary noise and what is actually a long-lasting effect. What I would argue is that there's certainly one lasting effect. We realize that epidemics can disrupt production, and that is one of the risks that need to be taken into account when designing international supply chains. There is increasing evidence that COVID is just the latest arrival of a series of epidemics that we've seen over the last 20, 30 years, and with rising frequency. With the destruction of natural habitat, increasing urbanization, we are likely to see more events like this. So again, do a proper risk management to ensure against this is definitely something that we have to do, and that is an element of a long-lasting trade strategy. Whether there are any other long-lasting effects, I think we still don't know. In the first wave, there were a lot of export bans of critical medical goods which were introduced and which were later taken back. So I was tempted to say this was just panic reaction, something short that doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. But just last week, we've seen that the EU introduces export controls on COVID-19 vaccines. Mm-hmm. And to me, this feels like a relapse to the panic reaction in the first wave of the pandemic. We don't know yet whether this introduction of export controls, which is of course not an export ban, will lead to retaliation or other actions from trade partners. It might not. But there is a risk that vaccine nationalism further undermines global division of labor. And there is a risk that this will harm us all when it comes to combating COVID as much as designing production in the most effective way.
Sometimes it's our tradition. We choose to make our interviewees omnipotent policymakers for a day, Christian. So I'm going to put you in charge of the EU's trade strategy for today. What are you going to do?
What I would like to do has something to do with trade strategy, but it's actually larger than that. I think what is holding the EU back particularly is its decision-making mechanisms when it comes to the intersection of trade policy and foreign policy.
Yes.
Where unanimity is required, the EU is very slow to act. It's very easy to use divide and rule tactics on the EU. And that is a huge burden for the EU to have an efficient strategy to survive and to do well in an era of geoeconomic globalization.
Christian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Christian's book is called Europe's Trade Strategy for the Age of Geoeconomic Globalization. It's the CEPR Press. It's a free download from VoxEU. So if you want to find out what he's going to do in detail when he is in charge of trade policy, well, download it and read it. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the most innovative economic research every week, so subscribe to Vox Talks, you never miss an episode. And remember, you can find more than 12 years of Vox Talks at voxeu.org/vox-talks.